Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 469th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Gall. I'm a family doc and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta. And last podcast, what we did is we started to talk about our thinking and our thinking errors and stuff like that. We started out by going over some interesting little fun facts about conspiracy theories. So we talked about things like a willingness to draw connections in events and see patterns and things and then kind of assume the worst is behind it. And that lends itself to this kind of good versus evil, us versus them thinking. Mm-hmm. That's very common in that. And the power of a very compelling narrative that helps you understand or at least reconcile something that's happening in life. So an example of that was a lot of people were devastated by the loss of Diana. So there's lots of conspiracy theories mm-hmm. around the death of Princess Diana because it was so awful and hard to reconcile that there had to be something more sinister. Things that we feel are out of control in this world. I've heard people think about groups like the Illuminati and all of these kind of things that are controlling things. Or if I don't really want Barack Obama to be president, I might join the birthers because the narrative is something that I need. So we talked about conspiracy theories a bit, and then we moved on to talking about three kind of central thinking errors that we're going to spend some time on, and that is getting distracted. And we drew a comparison there between a magic show and how that distraction in that magic show is so much more. It's about a narrative, a story, something that allows us to really believe in and be part of something. So we don't mind when something else is happening. We kind of let that go because we're enjoying the narrative and the story so much.
Yeah.
The next piece was how opinions are very firm. Once they're formed, they become almost impossible to break apart. And the last is how our confidence is generally at its highest when we know the least about something.
Yeah. No, exactly. So we're going to build on those.
Right. And we're specifically going to go back to narratives. And we're going to spend time first building one of the narratives that I know many of you know so well. And it's still happening today. Mm-hmm. That narrative is oxidative stress. So you've probably heard of oxidative stress. And you've heard about oxidative or antioxidants and how they're good for us. And when you hear about oxidative stress or when you hear about any of these things, what we've done is we're fed pieces of information that we don't really necessarily know a lot about, but they sure do sound compelling because they sound sciencey.
Yeah.
And Tim Caulfield talks about this, the idea of the use of science actually as a distraction to build against science itself. Yeah. So using sciencey language to build naturopathic or homeopathy treatments is they'll use a lot of the time sciencey language. Well, in oxidative stress, we use words like free radicals. Mm-hmm. Lycopenes and apoptosis,
and I love that word because I looked it up probably 10 times and I still forget what it is.
And what I found with apoptosis, it's more than just dying of the cell. It's complete gonzo, gone, dead.
Yeah, like, and the Death Star apart. The Death Star comes in somewhere, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's totally part of it.
Yeah, and you and I have talked about this before in that. You know, if you go to a talk on anything and if you see lots of mechanistic slides with arrows and figures that are clearly not, you know, that are sort of not actual pictures of anything, but they just sort of someone's drawn them and they all link to each other and go around in a circle. The more of those, probably the more bullshit they're saying.
Yeah. And the more, and if you look at a cell met, if there's a picture of a cell with a, you know, the cytoplasmic reticulum and all of that, you know that for the most part, that's BS. So
the only thing I do want to say, because I may get into trouble with that. It's not BS if you are going to a talk to try and figure out how they work.
Yes, absolutely.
But it may be bullshit if you are trying to figure out if they work.
Well, to take the vaccines for COVID right now, mRNA vaccines, they're totally new. Mm-hmm. And I did find some of this physiology stuff interesting. But it was after we got the results. Like, I didn't really try and learn it until we got the results saying they work like a hot damn. Then I was like, okay, now I'm interested, because I didn't need the narrative before. I thought the narrative would be a distraction. Now I'm interested because it's science-y, and I'm a nerd.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a nerd, but the use of it without real data, that's where we run into problems.
Yeah.
And our example here is oxidative stress, and it didn't take me more than probably 2 to 3 minutes to find all sorts of pictures of cell membranes with and the nucleus of the cell and the mitochondrium and how different vitamins, antioxidant vitamins, work at each level, whether it's the lysosome or the mitochondria, and it's absolutely crazy. And that in itself is so compelling. If I can imagine that the endoplasmic reticulum depends on vitamin E and vitamin A to do its function, and a bunch of pictures can show me that, it is so compelling to believe that it must be beyond essential, and therefore the more of it, the better. Yeah. Like, that's kind of how our...
Yeah, and again, we're not necessarily saying that the science that showed that vitamin E has an effect on endoplasmic reticulum is bad science. In fact, some of that is outstanding science.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
But that in and of itself doesn't say why we should use them.
No, not at all. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but that's what happened. We got the story of oxidative stress. We got the big words like lycopene and apoptosis and free radical, which I guess you imagine a mob charging a scene or something.
Yeah.
And that was not meant to be relevant to today. It just ended up being that way.
Yeah. It's that's a little too close, Mike.
Yeah, it's a little too close. But then if we get down to that, you know, absolutely microscopic layer where we know what's not only going on in the cell, but what's going on in the organs within the cell. Mm-hmm. Like that if we know that level, we must know whether it works or not and why it would work.
Is it organelles?
I think it's organelles.
Yeah.
I think it's organelles.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so we bought into the vitamin A and E, and I remember sending patients to see some of my colleagues coming back on vitamin A and E for every time every new patient would be on them. And it just made absolute sense. And then we did 78 randomized control trials and studied just shy of 300,000 people. And we found that vitamin A and E were killing one in every 200 over 3.5 years.
Yeah.
And it was done with the absolute best intentions, based on great basic science, and then an extrapolation to how it must be effective at a patient level.
And vitamin A and vitamin E, I mean, there are some people who can, you know, have patented, I guess, certain versions of them. But in essence, it was one, you can get it free by eating in some cases. But these are very relatively inexpensive. You can buy expensive vitamins, but you can get them very inexpensively. So it's not, you know, it's way more than it, this is way more. It's not money that's driving this.
Right. It's not. It's a fascinating interest. And we could talk a lot about what goes behind it with the science and the storytelling and getting grants and all of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that drives
a lot of it for sure.
That drives a lot of it. Like, we could talk about vitamin D and why we're still having big trials of vitamin D when we're like, I don't know why that keeps getting funded. Like, we know it doesn't work. But then what I did is I took that information that we now know that at least the antioxidant vitamins are causing harm. And it should make us give pause to the idea of supplementing with antioxidants is a good thing. But it took me, again, less than a couple minutes to find a soda pop that part of its advertising is it has additional antioxidants in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It took me very little time to find out research that's being promoted as potentially helpful for diabetes and albuminuria by adding antioxidant vitamins, and finding books on the ultimate guide to antioxidant nutraceuticals.
With the antioxidant nutraceuticals, there's a lot of basic science there. But
oh, there is.
Yeah.
There's a ton.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we don't know if they actually do anything positive at all. We absolutely don't know that. And the only suggestion we've had where we've taken antioxidant vitamins and given them, they've been harmful.
Yeah.
Except for macular degen. There's some research that can be helpful there. But one of the things that I did in this, when we looked at this, and if I didn't imply it strongly enough, I certainly do sometimes when I do other talks, and that is that we're using this kind of as scare tactics, like apoptosis and showing a cell that's absolutely dying and falling apart, and the words like free radicals and all of that. They have a sense of scariness to them. And you might think, do we in medicine actually scare people?
Well, we do that, but you're right, and we get that just a second. But it's also if you can say it's why we in medicine why we choose to use Latin terms, because it sounds like we know what we're talking about.
Absolutely, and again, that's part of the narrative. I know, and there is evidence that, like, I think there was one of my colleagues was telling me years ago. So don't ever try and get me. This might be another story, but he said that physicians generally have large vocabularies than the average. Yeah. And it's understandable because we thrive on using big words.
Yeah.
When myocardial infarction and heart attack, right? Like, it's, but anyhow, let's get into some examples. And James, you know, I've stolen these from you over the years.
And you know, the lawsuits are ongoing, but continue.
But continue to make me rich.
Yes, yes.
So osteoporosis, as you know, James, is the
silent thief.
Silent thief. It's stealing your bones away.
Yeah.
Or at least stealing the components of your bones away. Yeah. And then blood pressure is the silent killer.
Yeah.
And even I brought it up, heart attacks. I thought that I'm not sure why that came into its term, but I found out from, actually, it was at the BS Medicine Conference years ago, James. I was chatting with one of our speakers, a pulmonologist, and he said to me that he had just come from a meeting where their group was trying to change the name of COPD exacerbation to lung attacks.
Right.
Because he felt that it would have, he jokingly said, those damn cardiologists got such great mileage out of heart attack.
Right. Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And you know, the other silent killer is type 2 diabetes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, you just, I think it'd be fascinating to go back, but I think, you know, a lot of these things do come from marketing.
And then it takes the next step of, now let's talk not even about like things like a heart attack, but let's go into cholesterol. And we haven't called cholesterol, or that we may have, I just don't know of it, you know, something, some sinister name, but people see it as that.
Mm-hmm.
They see it like, if I told, you know, most of my patients that their cholesterol is high, they're, when they get their lipids done, they're not so concerned about me calculating their risk. What they really want to know is my cholesterol high or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that, because we've taught them to fear it so much.
Yeah. And the one way I say is if you had zero cholesterol, boy, you'd be in trouble. You know, you wouldn't have a hormone. None of your cell membranes would work and you'd have no hormones.
Yeah. I mean, and this is, but the, you know, the making things scary is part of our narrative process.
But, you know, you got to wonder where, I wonder, you know, I'm just literally talking off the top of my head. I mean, has that always been what medicine did, do you think? Or is this something, you know, in the last 50 or 60 years?
Socrates, they were.
Yeah,
they were,
I wonder.
Rubbing their hands together, laughing maniacally. Back
yeah,
in
I don't know. It's yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure.
I don't know either.
Yeah, there's a great research question for the next med student resident listening. So we're going to deal one more story, and then we're going to get into kind of what happens to stories. And this story, I think you've heard us talk about
before. Yeah, we've done it, but it bears repeating, at least in a quick way.
In an abbreviated way. So imagine the sick heart after a heart attack. And as you guys know, after a myocardial infarction, there is, and I'm using both words now, you the timing of the heart is often thrown off, at least in the immediate short term. And what was found was that the more of extra beats that occurred, abnormal beats, the more likely patients were to die. And so it just made sense that, you know, if this person had 200 extra beats in an hour and this person had 30 and the 200 person died, and you saw that pattern time and time again, that you got to do something about those extra beats. And so that was exactly the approach, to try and eliminate the extra beats to try and save lives. And they came up with a couple of medicines that would do that. And they worked a bit like a hot damn. They
increased, got rid of most of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you had 100 in an hour, you would now have 15.
Yeah.
They were very successful at that surrogate outcome. But also when they were single-mindedly targeting that, it seemed very reassuring.
Yeah.
And when they tried to do a clinical trial of this,
But the other caveat is that, and we did it without any evidence for probably 2 decades.
Yeah. And we'll get to what we did to people. But when we were trying to, you know, not we, you and I, James, but when the people were trying to resolve this conundrum, they tried to investigate, but many docs were afraid to give their patients over to not get that they might be randomized to the placebo arm. Mm-hmm. They were nervous about it. And so what happened? It was almost 1,500 patients for 10 months. And in the placebo arm, 3% of them had died. And in the treatment arm, the arm that had so drastically reduced the extra beats, mm-hmm. 8% had died.
Yeah.
So we were killing 1 in every 21 patients coming to the CCU to get our help. And with a great narrative,
mm-hmm.
and the best of intentions.
But I don't know.
Narrative's so compelling.
And I don't know, I'm a little bit older than you, but I don't know. So you probably weren't practicing. This came out in 1989. You probably weren't practicing then, right?
No, I wasn't.
Yeah.
I was going to med school in a few years. Yeah.
Yeah. But I remember I was working at St. Paul's Hospital at the time, and we did, you know, we, at that time we all did the quintessential journal clubs, and, mm-hmm. you know, and this was when clinical pharmacology was very big, and there was a whole bunch of clinical pharmacologists and pharmacists at our hospital. And when this came out, we did a journal club on it, and all of us were just going, what's going on here? Like, it was really,
what the hell? Come on.
Yeah. And like, this is not, it's not like it, 5% increase in death or in bad outcomes. Wow. We had not seen this before. There was nothing on our radar that hit as hard as this did.
It's not like a 5% increase in the level of microalbuminuria crossing a certain.
Yeah, yeah.
This is death.
Yeah. And I want people to realize this is only 30 years ago. It's not that long in the scheme of things. And so
it was the real, one of the real triggers for evidence-based medicine.
It was,
wake up and say, maybe we need to not buy into the narrative so quickly. And let's talk about another narrative. This is one that did affect me, James, because mm-hmm. I remember, and I'll tell this story in a sec, but you found this information, which I was most impressed with, because I had looked for it, probably spent one whole day looking for the genesis of this factoid, which was that beta blockers should never be used in heart failure.
Right.
And I could not find the origins of that truth, but you found that it was from, most likely from, an American Journal of Cardiology 1966 article, in which they looked at a bunch of different kind of basically case series of patients.
Yeah, and not a lot.
No, and this was 3 patients with heart failure who had sinus tachy, and they were given beta blockers, and 20 minutes later, they noticed in these 3 patients their heart failure had worsened.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that, like anything, and that's why, I mean, I think you're the same, James, in almost all the research studies I read, I don't even read the discussion anymore.
The only reason I read the discussion is I want to know sort of, and by, I don't mean this negatively, but I want to see the spin they're going to put on it, because that's what people are going to, that's the story, that's the narrative they're going to be telling.
Yeah, exactly. That would be, and I avoid it because I don't want to hear their narrative. You know, I remember one time you were talking about reading the discussion and you said, I read it as the funny pages.
Yeah. No, I read it for my own amusement. And I wonder, you know, it's just, where are they going with this? and so in this case.
This one is a fascinating one, right? And I'll read out to the audience what they said. So why did they get worse heart failure? It presumably results from weakened contractile force of the heart following the removal of the catecholamine drive. There is frequently a fall in cardiac output with the prolongation of systole. So there's your story.
That's smart because there's a lot of decently big words.
Yeah, there's big words there. There's things that kind of like, and this is, and I'm sure you want to look at the Starling curve now, James.
Yeah, I do.
Take a pause in the podcast so you can look at that. And henceforward, and this didn't stay, but obviously for a long time it stayed, beta blockers were contraindicated in heart failure. Yeah.
And when I was in practice back at the, when this sort of contraindication, we literally, when we saw a prescription for beta blocker in a person who was in a heart failure, we would go, what on earth is that prescriber thinking? What an idiot.
Story, right? I presenting patients on internal medicine the next morning and reading off their list of meds and what they were admitted for. And the guy had heart failure and I included his meds was a beta blocker. And oh boy, did I get torn apart.
Yeah.
Because I had forgot to stop his beta blocker. Are you trying to kill him?
Yeah, exactly.
Great, helpful educational content.
Yeah, that's always a good lesson. Are you trying to kill that person? What are you? Yeah, we would phone people up and say almost that. Are you trying to kill them? And you know, it would be
and that confident.
We just wanted to make sure that you knew that beta blockers were contraindicated in heart failure, and contraindicated is a powerful word.
Yeah. It's very powerful. Yeah. So, and it was, and we were stopping them. And then for some crazy reason in the mid 1990s, we started to do RCTs on this very question. And 21 RCTs were done with 23,000 patients. And they found that they reduced death over 2 years from 19% down to 14%. So bingo, bango, their first line.
Yeah.
They did a complete reversal, right? From contraindicated to first line. And when you read about why they're first line now, because there has to be a physiologic argument, the things that are said are they block the catecholamines, which in 1966 was the reason that they were bad.
Yeah.
Now it's the reason that they're good. Mm-hmm. And they slow the heart rate to allow more time for filling, where before, they slow the heart rate and that causes more problems with cardiac filling and cardiac output.
Yeah, a fall in cardiac output.
Yeah, so yeah. It's fascinating. We actually take the same story and just tweak it a tiny bit or nothing at all, and then have a complete reversal of recommendation.
Yeah. And exactly. And now there's again, I'm going to throw in like about two other caveats. Here's where we could have got misled. One, the where we got into problems first was with IV beta blockers, and maybe that's different than PO. And it may be, could you imagine, it would be not unusual if you were to take a bunch of people with heart failure, just like when you flip a coin. Some of them will get worse. But if you just happen to get three patients who decided to get all of a sudden worse, regardless of whether you gave them anything, that could have been what it was.
Absolutely. That could have been what it was.
And then it becomes a paper because it's legitimate. You can, I think case studies are legitimate publications, but boy, oh boy, you can't take away causation. I mean, the only way you could take away, you'll figure out causation is if you took these people and you gave it to them, stopped it, gave it to them, stopped it, gave it to them, stopped it. And each time they worsened their heart failure. Then you'd go, maybe it was the IV beta blockers. And at that time, as you know, our friend and colleague, Bob Ragno, they as medical students, they used to inject beta blockers into themselves to see what would go.
Because they were doing exercise stuff. He was a science-y guy, though, right?
Yeah.
He wanted to experiment. That's really what
he
wanted to do.
And they were using massive doses of beta blockers. Like, you know, upwards of, I think, I may be wrong, but I upwards of a gram. You know, and that's a lot. That basically means this is what your heart does. It goes thump, and then you wait a minute, and then it goes thump.
It's like that terrible old movie Flatliners or whatever.
Yeah. So,
but then that got me thinking, James. When I was and you can pick so many times where we've been like, look at corticosteroids in COVID, right?
Yeah,
we used a couple stories from a couple cases early in disease, and it was contraindicated until we proved that it's actually the most effective therapy that we have. So, yeah. Not talking about the vaccines, because this is when people already have the illness, but
at least in a select group.
Yes.
Yeah.
In those who are sick and in hospital. Yeah. So it's interesting how we still are going to keep falling prey to it, and with the
and sorry, Mike, and I was going to add though. You know what though. You know, and again, we're basing that probably on, you know, maybe a couple of studies or three. I think the best available evidence at that point points out to that. But, you know, it wouldn't, you know, we may never do any more studies on it. But I'm still not I'm never 1,000% convinced of almost anything, you know.
Yeah, not too many.
Yeah.
But the ones we've chosen today for our primary examples.
Yeah.
They are big, like 23,000 for beta blockers.
I agree.
Those are pretty, and I don't think we need another antioxidant study. I really don't.
Shouldn't we mix an antioxidant with a beta blocker
and a vitamin D?
Yeah,
and we get. A statin. Well, the one actually we know works, and the one we know doesn't work. Yeah. So, yeah. But when I started to think about, in particular, the beta blocker, when it got me thinking, what our stories are. And our stories are really like silly putty.
Go on.
Because they can be molded to whatever we need.
Yeah.
And they can be molded to look smart. I found a picture of silly putty molded into the look like a brain. Mm-hmm. You can take the silly putty and you can rub it on a newspaper and it will pick up that story.
Right.
And it can be used to look smart. It can be used to pick up stories. And there's even science behind silly putty. And so it can be made to sound smart.
Yeah. But when it picks up the story off the paper, it's in a mirror image. So
it's the racemic isomer.
Yeah. Yes. It's the racemic isomer. That's another, oh man, do we ever go down racemic? Yeah. I used to think racemic was so important. Man, oh man.
I'm sure you did. But obviously we're taking it to the extreme and making fun of it. But there is an element to how silly our stories are. And if we aren't cautious and remind ourselves, no, wait a minute, this is a magic show and it's a bit like silly putty because it can just pick up any story it needs. I mean, that's exactly what happened with beta blockers. Mm-hmm. We used the same words, but we just reversed our recommendations and kept almost the exact same story.
Yeah.
And why it works versus why it was wrong.
Yeah, and we're giving many examples of where, you know, where we're sort of the opposite of what we believed is actually now likely the case. And some people are going to think, well, you know, you're just picking up, you know, it's kind of like when, you know, the one example that everyone brings up about the problem with cohort trials is, you know, the estrogen. You know, well, there you go. You can't trust any. Well, that is an example, maybe. But that doesn't,
there's,
you
know, but like about smoking.
Exactly. And you know, and I don't know the exact number, but certainly it's mine. What I think I have read somewhere is that, you know, probably 60 to 70% of cohort studies at some point have RCTs showing that they were correct. They're not all going to be correct. And we haven't even got into the, this is just the sort of the tip of the iceberg, because you can also say there may be some things that do work, but they don't work nearly as well as you think. So that's
not as well as we thought they did.
Yeah. So that's another narrative that we're saying things that don't work, but what about the things that do work, but not really that much? And that's, it's fascinating.
I think the problem with the story though, James, is not the way you've laid it out. Like, if you take, again, go back to the vaccines for COVID.
Yeah.
The idea of this mRNA vaccine was pretty novel.
Yes.
And it made physiologic sense and all of that stuff. But they proved it with a randomized controlled trial. Mm-hmm. That's the piece that was missing. Because if we started to take those vaccines and inject them before we got the evidence, I think the story, all of that would have also still been false.
It
would have been a mistake. It's true of antioxidants. That's what happened. We had a good story and we ran with it. Vitamin D.
Yeah.
We had a good story. And now people believe in vitamin D so strongly that it's an impenetrable belief.
Yeah.
You cannot get them to recognize that the randomized controlled trials do not support that.
Yeah. And I think it's important to point out, just because you have a randomized controlled trial showing it works doesn't mean the mechanism that you were talking about is true.
Statins are that.
Yeah, like, that could be an example for sure. Yeah.
They're also they're also anti-inflammatory. And I don't know that that works either. I've mentioned on this very podcast that I think what happens is when you take a statin, it crosses across your small intestine, gets absorbed into your blood, and then turns into magic fairies.
No, it's the esophagus. It's absorbed through the esophagus.
Oh, the esophagus.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
You're not disagreeing with the magic fairies portion of
that. No, God, no. You're just, that's true. It's just the direction.
That's solid.
Yeah.
That's solid science, baby.
Yeah. But anyway, so go ahead.
To death, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So, because I think we're getting to the end of this podcast, and so I mean, I think, you know, you've heard us. Mike's said this quote about 1,000 times on the podcast, but I why don't you say it again, and then that'll be the end of this segment.
Which is
Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh no! But that's what we're going to talk about next. We're going to talk about. We won't let the cat out of the bag. We'll talk about Simon and Garfunkel. And we'll talk about another daring duo called Dunning and Koenig.
Yes.
Or Kruger. Dunning and Kruger.
Yeah.
And we'll bring both of those daring duos at the next podcast. We'll be much faster in the next one because the narratives don't have to be quite as long.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, that sounds good. Anything else you want to bring up?
Nope, I think that's it, James. Thanks.
Yeah, so thanks as always for listening, and come back for part 3 of this adventure.
Talk to you later.